I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. What did he say at his inaugural? Pick yourself up and dust yourself off. And President Obama is appearing to try to do just that today after yesterday's disastrous withdrawals of two key picks, including Tom Daschle. Today, Obama's Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, announced a sharp limit on executive pay for companies receiving government bailout money. And lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are debating channeling more money to homeowners. Well, we're thrilled that Elizabeth Warren has found time for us today. She's professor of law at Harvard University and chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel, whose tough job it is to guarantee that bailout handouts are in the best interest of the American people. So, Professor Warren, welcome.
Thank you.
And I want to be clear, your panel oversees TARP money. This is the original bailout money, the Toxic Asset Relief Program. It's Wall Street money, not the economic stimulus bill, which is currently being debated. But what are you hearing today about salaries and maybe more money going to homeowners? What have you been hearing?
Well, I'm actually very pleased to hear this. Now, I should say, you know, I haven't even had time to talk with the rest of my panel about this. So, you know, these are my views alone on it. Mm-hmm. But this really means someone in Treasury is listening. And it means that we have a real change in position here. It's not the case that, you know, the smart guys are all going to go into a room and lock the door and decide how taxpayer money is going to be divided up and then come out and make an announcement to the rest of us. It really sounds like somebody is beginning to get the message that what we do here involves the American people. It's their money. They have a right to know about it. And more importantly, they have a right to be part of this process in helping us figure out how we're going to get out of this mess.
Well, today the Obama administration indicated that CEO salaries for companies that accepted bailout money, the salaries would be cut to $500,000. There's already some limitations, but this seems like a pretty sharp cut. They can also be paid in vested stock. But I'm hearing that that means that they can't take that stock until the company pays the government back the bailout money.
Right. You know, of course, there are some people who'd sit around and say, gee, I'd like to see my paycheck cut to $500,000. Right. But, you know, this is a really sharp turnaround from where we've been before.
Well, now, is it really? Because they also appear to be saying that banks that are healthy and receive money, and we remember that healthy banks were forced to take money so that they could sort of hide who was in trouble and who wasn't. These banks that are healthy can opt out of the salary cap. And we're just wondering, can't other banks now complain, as Forbes is saying today, that this means that bad banks are going to lose their best people to healthy banks?
Well, you know, I'm waiting to see that happen. The notion that I ran a bank in such a risky manner that the only way it can survive is with lots of government money, and therefore I'm a plum executive that you want to pick off, is something that some people might question.
John Stewart had a great line. He played sound from then CEO of Merrill Lynch, John Thain, saying just that. We're going to lose our best people if you cap salaries. And John Stewart said, you have no best people. You know, you're practically in bankruptcy.
Well, you know, this is an issue that goes on all the time in the bankruptcy world. And the reality is there's a disciplining effect because it's very hard in the just outside the banking sector, in any part of the world, when you run a business down into Chapter 11 or into liquidation, the odds that you can get another top job somewhere else just about approach zero.
Yeah. Well, Elizabeth Warren, your committee, your panel has issued two reports on the TARP plan, pretty critical. A third is due this week. Can you just give us the headline?
Well, the headline so far is that we have a lot of questions about the TARP program. That was the first report. The second report was we asked the Secretary of Treasury to answer those questions, and he answered some of them, but we still have a lot of questions. The third report, which will be out at the end of this week, is about focusing in on one of the questions that we asked, and we made our own independent investigation, and that is whether or not the American people got a fair deal in the investments that have been made to date.
Well, and this goes to questions that you had. You had 10 questions that you wanted to ask mm-hmm. about the TARP plan, including what's the Treasury strategy? Is it helping to reduce foreclosures? You know, what kind of money is going to be coming from the banks that get the money to Americans? Do you still have some of those questions?
Yes, ma'am,
yeah.
We do.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we did this, we started out, we had 10 questions, a lot of sub-questions, you know, because you have to kind of drill down on this stuff. And so ultimately, we sent 45 questions over to Treasury. They didn't answer 26 of them. They sent us back a long letter, but they didn't answer 26 of them. And so we just put a grid up on the web and said, here was our question, here was Treasury's response, if any, and here's our response to their response. And so, you know, we're keeping score out there.
Well, and you know, you said the overarching is, you know, are Americans getting a good deal? Do you have, you know, I know it's, I sort of just asked you this, but do you have any more answer to that?
Well, that's what we're going to be talking right. about. At the end of the week, we're going to put some numbers out on this. We've actually done some hard work on this and gotten some very good people to work with us to help value these transactions.
Well, Elizabeth Warren, can you also tell us what, you know, from your vantage point, happened? You know, if you read only the headlines,
yeah.
you'd think the TARP money was spent on CEO bonuses and conferences, and the rest was sort of like held tight and not lent out. But where did it go?
Robin, this is a really shocking answer that I'm going to give you. No one knows for sure. And the reason for that is that back in November, when Secretary Paulson was putting this whole thing together, it was all about pushing the money into the hands of the banks, whether they wanted it or not. In some cases, they at least purported not to want it. In other cases, they desperately wanted it. But putting it into their hands and not asking for any further accountability. Well, if you don't ask for some accountability, you don't know what happened to the money.
And explain why that's possible, because if I have one check bounce, you know, they know within a second.
That's
explain
right.
why that is possible not to know.
Well, it's possible not to know. Let me put it this way. If you don't ask, you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And Treasury pushed our money forward and didn't ask for any accounting on it. And so it means it's entirely possible that some of the money did go to lending, as Treasury said was its intent. It's possible, though, that some of the money ended up being used to buy other banks or to buy assets in foreign countries. I mean, it's you just don't know. Or that it got stuffed into banks, into bank vaults, for them to hold on to as they continued to lose value and decline. So it's sort of their hedge against failure.
Well, let's take a look ahead. We're hearing lawmakers, as we said, both Republicans and Democrats, are debating something you've been asking for a long time, which is relief for homeowners. But the debate seems to be over which homeowners? Struggling homeowners, which the Democrats seem to be tilting more to people on the verge of foreclosure. And if I read it right, Republicans seem to be saying, no, everybody should get help. What's your sense of the debate?
Well, you know, this crisis, in my view, started with the homeowner. It started with a lot of really lousy mortgage products that some people were tricked into buying. Some people ran into it, you know, at full tilt. But the consequence was that we inflated this housing market. We destabilized financially a lot of families, and then because these things were bundled up into assets and sold throughout the economy, we ultimately destabilized the American economy and the worldwide economy. Until we stop and wrestle directly with that problem, we can't get this economy back on an even footing. There are too many corporate books that are based on a sort of notion of stream of revenue that's going to come from all these little families that are supposed to be paying their mortgages. And until we get that straightened out, it's just not going to happen.
But we understand that Treasury Secretary Geithner is now turning away from what was a big idea about a month ago, the idea of a bad bank, the government buying all the bad assets, you know, which mortgages are not going
right.
to be paid, and putting them in a bad bank where they stay until they regain some of their value and get off the books.
But notice, Robin, what we're still talking about at that point, that's a top-down kind of solution. That's saying, okay, you've got the asset here, you've got it in a tranched mortgage-backed security, we're going to take your mortgage-backed security, we're going to pull it over here.
Okay,
that's
and I have to jump in and say, and don't get us started on tranches, but this
exactly.
is when you slice up these bundled securities and sell the slices, and it includes...
You bet,
yeah.
Because the point is, this, you can start at that end of the snake, or you can go to the other end. And the other end is to say, wait a minute, what we're going to deal with are the families themselves who are trying to stay in these homes, who are trying to make these payments. We need to find a more rational way to get these things properly valued and for people who can pay, to have them paying on mortgage and sort of mortgages, and get these streams of revenues both steady and predictable for the rest of the economy. You know, simply moving assets into a bad bank doesn't do that all by itself. The way we get stability is we get families back into the business of, you know, getting up in the morning and going to work and earning those paychecks, and at the end of the day, paying their mortgages, paying their bills, taking care of their kids.
Well, and how would you do that? I mean, give them money to get ahead on the mortgages? Or,
no.
You know, we can't wait to create jobs.
No. No. Yeah. We have to deal directly with these mortgages. You know, when we've got a bunch of houses out there that are worth $100,000 and the mortgage on it is $140,000, somebody's going to have to take that hit. And the question is it going to be, are we going to pretend that some homeowner who's now in a mortgage, you know, whose cost is now doubled, is somehow going to find the money to be able to keep paying in what's now this totally irrational financial deal? Or are we going to say, you know, the investors are just going to have to belly up here and recognize the loss?
So you're saying banks have to renegotiate the mortgages, write them down to what they're really worth?
Well, I want to be clear. It's not just banks. What we're talking about here is a lot of this stuff is held in very diffuse ownership now. And that's what makes it such a pain. You know, when we went into the crisis in the late 1980s, savings and loan crisis, I lived down in Texas when the market just totally tanked. Unfortunately, I needed to sell a house at that time because I got a different job out of state. But the bank, there was one banker who could sit down with you because there was one banker who held your mortgage. And that banker would sit down and talk to you and say, okay, you know, what can you do? Here's what we can do. And so a lot of bad mortgages got worked out into something that was the best deal under bad circumstances for both the borrower and for the banker. Today, with just what you were talking about, all the tranches and bundling and so on, often there's not a bank on the other side. What's on the other side is some trust that's sliced and diced, and multiple banks may hold pieces of this along with investors from my pension fund, mm-hmm. from China, from all kinds of other places. So part of the role, I think, now of law in this area is to find a way to get back to rational decisions that can't be made when you've got so many players.
Elizabeth Warren, we just have a few seconds. I want to ask you, do you think that wages are going to have to go up? Because you told us a year ago, you predicted that consumer spending would just drop because, not because people are spending, you know, living outside of their means, but more because their costs have risen, like health care, but their earnings have been flat. Do you think that that's got to be a key here?
The key is you are exactly right to focus on the fundamentals, the economics of the family. If we think that we're going to rebuild this economy by keeping wages flat with rising expenses, I'm just here to say it's not going to happen. Expenses have got to come down or wages have got to go back up, or else we don't have an American middle class. And without an American middle class, we don't have an economy.
That's Elizabeth Warren, professor of law at Harvard University, but also chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel, taking a hard look at the bailout. She's got a report from that panel coming later this week. I just think we heard a lot of it today, and Professor Warren, we thank you for that. And I know you also have a report coming out on regulations, and we look forward to that as well. Professor Warren, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Well, just ahead, did you know there are 200 families on a waiting list to adopt children with Down syndrome? Well, that story in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll have the latest on the mother who gave birth to 8 children with 6 more at home. Of course, it's been raising questions about whether a doctor should step in and tell a woman no more. But our guest today is more concerned with a separate issue, the children who are already with us. Robin Steele works with the Down Syndrome Association of Greater Cincinnati. She helps match families who feel they need to give up a child with Down syndrome with families who want to adopt them. Sarah Palin put a spotlight on the issue of Down syndrome during the presidential campaign, but now that spotlight has faded. And while 90% of women whose fetuses test positive for Down syndrome choose to abort, according to research from King's College in London, about 5,000 babies are born in the U.S. every year with the condition, and some parents feel they just can't handle it. Well, that's where Robin Steele comes in. Last year, she was involved in more than 100 adoptions, and now she's got more than 200 families on her waiting list. Robin joins us from Cincinnati. And Robin, you know a little bit about this because you and your husband also have adopted 4 children with Down syndrome. How did this start for you?
Basically, when we met our daughter, Martha. Martha had been born to a single mom who was not in a position to parent a child, and so she released Martha for adoption. But when Martha was diagnosed with Down syndrome, the agency that took custody of her did not believe she was adoptable. So we actually met her when she was almost 4 years old, and she was living in a group home here in Cincinnati, the expectation being that she would grow up in that group home and move on to an adult group home. And we fell in love with her and wanted to make her a part of our family.
You ultimately adopted 7 other children with special needs, so you have, 11 children with special needs?
We have 13 children altogether. 2 of our children are foster children, and they both have special needs. Our 8 children by adoption also have special needs, and then we have a birth son.
Well, your personal experience led you to start hooking up adoptable children with Down syndrome with families who want them. You keep a sort of registry of families waiting to adopt, and we understand it's gotten to the point where you have a waiting list of more than 200 families. What do they say to you?
You know, 99% of the families that contact me who are interested in adopting have had a prior experience with a child with Down syndrome. They may be a birth family already who was parenting a child with Down syndrome, or they may be a professional that's worked with a child in an educational setting or as a therapist for a child with Down syndrome. And that experience has been a positive one.
Well, tell us about your kids. Martha, who you spoke of, the first child you adopted, now 37. What is she doing?
Martha has lived on her own since 1993. She is currently engaged to be married, and her very special boyfriend, Clay, and Martha share an apartment living situation together.
Is he special needs as well?
He has some special needs, but he does not have Down syndrome.
Well, Martha works at a Jewish vocational center. Then there's Elizabeth, 28, who also lives on her own. She works at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Tony is 19, graduating from high school this year. Cody, 13, and in 7th grade. For people interested in adopting, aren't some Down syndrome children more high-functioning than others?
Our children, our 4 children, fall in the moderate range of mental retardation, which is the vast majority of children with Down syndrome will fall in that range. There are children who are more severely, profoundly involved, and children who fall in the very, borderline normal range.
And what is at the core of a child with Down syndrome? We've had people try to put their finger on it, and if you could as well.
You know, children with Down syndrome sometimes stereotypically are thought to be, always happy and always loving. And I think,
And always childlike.
And that, while it's a belief that's held by a lot of very well-meaning people, does not recognize the fact that children with Down syndrome grow up into very capable adults and need to be given that opportunity as well.
Do you have to gently help adoptive parents understand that might be an appeal, that children with Down syndrome sometimes develop maybe a little slower, but you have to let them go?
I think for the most part, adoptive families know that and understand that. It's getting that information to birth families, because quite often they're surprised by the fact that children with Down syndrome do not remain children always, that they do grow up, and they grow up with potential and the ability to live independently. And all of those things are the important message that we need to share with birth families, because a lot of times they're making the decisions to make an adoption plan or to not continue a pregnancy based on their fear that their child will always be a high level of needs child.
Well, and you say that the biggest problem you face is the lack of information and other people's expectations, and sometimes other people's low expectations of what your kids could do, for instance. Can you give us some examples of that?
Oh, yeah. When we first were parenting our daughter Martha, and it was kind of a learn-as-you-go situation for us as well, but she was in a preschool program where at the time there were only children with disabilities, and what they expressed to us was that because Martha would never learn to read, there was no real benefit in her learning her lowercase alphabet. They exposed her to uppercase but not lowercase. And we knew that Martha had the ability, because we took Martha on vacation, and she had a set of magnet letters, lowercase magnet letters. And on that trip, she learned her lowercase letters and And we knew that she had the potential to read. And she, you know, now reading is very, very important to her. She reads the newspaper, she reads magazines, she does crossword puzzles like crazy. So those are the kinds of assumptions that we learn very quickly. You don't make assumptions because a child has an extra chromosome. You just let them learn and grow and build on their strengths.
That's Robin Steele of the National Adoption Awareness Program, part of the Down Syndrome Association of Greater Cincinnati. She has 4 adopted children with Down syndrome, 13 children in all. 8 of her other children also have special needs. Robin, thanks again for speaking with us. I'm not sure how you had the time.
The laundry is building up even as we speak.
Well, thanks so much and get back to it. Thank you.
Okay.
Scorching is one way it's being described. The first congressional testimony from the man who for a decade tried to convince regulators that money manager Bernard Madoff was a fraud. This morning, financial fraud investigator Harry Markopoulos of Whitman, Massachusetts, told a House subcommittee he feared for his life as he followed Madoff's money trail and tried to blow the whistle on him, only to find deaf and inexperienced ears at the Securities and Exchange Commission. Markopoulos called the SEC a captive and failed regulator, which roars like a mouse and fights like a flea. He said top officials at the agency, which he also said is propped up by government bailout funds, have not earned their paychecks and need to be replaced.
I gift-wrapped and delivered the largest Ponzi scheme in history to them, and somehow they couldn't be bothered to conduct a thorough and proper investigation because they were too busy on matters of higher priority. If a $50 billion Ponzi scheme doesn't make the SEC's priority list, then I want to know who sets their priorities.
Steve Guyman is an editor for the finance team for Bloomberg News Service. He was watching the hearing this morning. Steve, it was expected this was going to be, I think the New York Times wrote, beat up on the SEC day, but how bad was it?
It was as expected. Harry Markopoulos did use some fairly punchy language. He described the SEC as unable to investigate this fraud that he presented to them 9 years ago. His words, investigative ineptitude and financial illiteracy. Throughout more than 2 hours of testimony and responses to questions, Markopoulos said that he lost confidence in the SEC and didn't have confidence in any other entity that's set up to look at what happens on Wall Street, happens among broker-dealers in New York and elsewhere.
Well, here's New York Democrat Gary Ackerman asking Markopoulos what tipped him off about Madoff. Here's what Markopoulos had to say.
It took me about 5 minutes to figure out that he was a fraud, so it took extensive time and research. I basically read his strategy description, and I knew that wasn't the source of his returns because then I looked at his. I knew right away by looking at his performance chart, and I wish I had a whiteboard and an easel here, but I don't. So I'm going to give you a hand signal, and I'm going to show you what his performance return line looked like. It was a 45-degree angle, without any variation. It went in only one direction, up.
You know, we could hear, Steve, there, you know, some joking. There were zingers, one-liners, lawmakers falling over themselves to call Markopoulos a hero. But isn't there a problem here because weren't some of them overseeing the SEC?
To the extent that Congress provides the support to the Securities and Exchange Commission and to the extent that the SEC requests money from the government, yes, they are the overseer of the agency, of the regulator. But then after the Bernard Madoff story broke in the middle of December, there was a lot of accusations and a lot of comments about the failures by the SEC to take action. In fact, former chairman Christopher Cox, several days after Madoff was arrested in New York City, admitted that the SEC failed to identify or act on credible and reliable evidence tips that they were presented over the course of the previous decade, talking about what Bernard Madoff was doing and how he was able to continue to produce these returns. And I should point out, when Harry Markopoulos gestured in the hearing room with his arm at a 45-degree angle, he's talking about annual returns to investors in the Madoff Fund of more than 10% every single year, regardless of what happened to the market, whether the market was up or the market was down.
Well, staying with that idea before we move on of, you know, who's responsible, Markopoulos also said the brokerage industry's self-policing agency, which is FINRA, the Financial Industrial Regulatory Authority, was corrupt. The person who led FINRA until December was Mary Shapiro. Ms. Shapiro, that's President Obama's new SEC chair.
That is correct. And one of the things that a lot of people are going to be anticipating this week, later this week, is Mary Shapiro's first speech to the investing community. She's making her first speech on Friday here in Washington. A lot of people will be paying attention to what she has to say and how she's going to cast the future of the SEC, the types of enforcement they'll undertake. She's already pledged to reinvigorate the enforcement operation at the SEC, which would have been the point that would the part of the agency that would have taken the point on investigating Bernard Madoff. She's also talked about other issues, but primarily on enforcement, the Madoff episode, the case that went on for a number of years, and Harry Markopoulos' testimony today, speaking about his repeated efforts to reach out to the SEC and repeated rebuffs by all but a few people, resulting in no action by the SEC, the agency that's been set up to enforce securities laws in the United States.
Well, what he said is that after those 5 minutes of realizing you can't just have those profits all the time, you got to see a line go down every now and then, he said he tracked the so-called feeder funds. These are the funds that channeled investor money to Madoff. And he also said he's going to turn over a list of 12 feeder funds in Europe that he says the U.S. government doesn't even know about. What does that say about how this circle might widen?
We have been reporting since the middle of December that a lot of banks and a lot of other entities in Europe and other parts of the world, in addition to the United States, were tapped by the Madoff investment company for money that was plowed into his entity. Some of those entities have been identified in Europe, but what Markopoulos said today is he knows of at least 12 other funds so far unknown to European regulators. I think he cited the French specifically and the Swiss regulators as well, don't even know the identities of these funds. He's going to meet with the Inspector General, that's sort of the watchdog for the SEC, tomorrow in Washington, and will deliver a list of 12 funds, none of which he identified during his testimony today.
Right. He also said the SEC is over-lawyered, too slow, too young, too undereducated. But he had some criticism of the media. He said he couldn't even get coverage from the Wall Street Journal, for instance, because editors there were afraid of Madoff?
That's what he said. He described his frustration with trying to get the regulators to take action, so he felt it was time to go to the media and talk to a news organization. He presented the information, and in his words, he had a receptive audience with one editor here in Washington, but nothing ever materialized. In his words, the editors, as he said, as you point out, the editors were fearful of Madoff and decided not to pursue the story. I really can't speak about what the folks at the Wall Street Journal decided to do. Every news organization makes its own decisions about the stories it covers and how it goes about doing that.
But briefly, he's recommending that senior staff be fired, low-level lawyers be gotten rid of, that people who are outside of the industry, who've retired, come in so they don't have any row to hoe anymore. But what is the SEC saying?
Well, the SEC at this point on the Bernard Madoff case, they're not saying very much. They are precluded from speaking about it because it might compromise an ongoing investigation. A panel of five directors from the SEC, including the director of enforcement, appeared before the committee today, and in their prepared testimony, they basically spelled out what the agency has done since the arrest, but then they specifically state to avoid compromising the ongoing criminal investigation. They can't really talk about what they did, why they didn't do or did do certain things. They are talking about making some adjustments in their own internal rules for how they handle this, including reaching out and making inspections of these broker-dealers and financial advisors on a more frequent basis. The Madoff firm was registered in 2006. It had not yet had its first inspection by the SEC. They're going to try to change that, shorten the time period for the first inspection to avoid these things happening in the future.
And there may be another Madoff out there. Steve Guymon, editor for Bloomberg News Service. My apologies for channeling Elmer Fudd here with my cold, but thank you so much for your time today.
Okay.
And look at a story we're going to bring you in the days coming. The death of a top young doctor opens a window on drug abuse and anesthesiologists. That's in the days ahead on Here and Now. You're listening to Here and Now. Take just a minute now for a cautionary tale and a thank you to the fire, hazmat, and ambulance workers in my fair city, Cambridge, Massachusetts, who rescued me from my thermometer. I have that cold going around. It's no big deal, but I decided to take my temperature for the first time in 20 years. The thermometer tasted a little funny, so I took it out, and hey, where's that little bubble with the mercury on the end? Why, there it is, with a little mercury blob floating around on the counter. I called 911. They were a little flummoxed at first, then said, "We're coming to get it." Three fire trucks, several cars, 10 lovely guys milling on the street, another 10 or so crowding in my bathroom trying to trap the errant blob, and an EMT insisting that I go in the ambulance to the emergency room. At this point, I pictured my neighbors rappelling from their upper floors, throwing out their possessions. The scene on our street looked so disastrous, and I figured if I got into the ambulance, they would start a fundraiser for me. So I drove myself. At the hospital, much ado, and then conclusion. Elemental mercury, if swallowed, and we're not even sure I did, is non-toxic. And for a lovely parting gift, a digital thermometer, bringing me into the 21st century. So what have we learned here, except that I miss the whole dispose of your old thermometer safely movement? If you find mercury, how do you dispose of it, short of your town's entire expensive safety division carting it away? Joe Minot is with the Clean Air Council in Philadelphia. Joe, am I the only one who still has the old thermometer?
No, not at all. The Clean Air Council gets two or three calls a week from people who have dropped thermometers that contain mercury and are in a panic about it.
Well, place us in time. Are mercury thermometers banned?
They're not banned, though obviously we strongly discourage people from buying them. It's actually fairly hard to buy them. The biggest problem comes up with people like you, frankly, that have them in the house and suddenly decide to use them after 20 years.
Right.
And then there's a problem.
But help us with this, Joe, because I've also heard from listeners, you know, used to play with mercury as kids. I know this sounds awful, but, you know, they'd put it in their fingers. There were those toys where you had to move the mercury blob through a maze. And, of course, all the kids broke the maze to get the mercury out. Why is it so dangerous?
It is a fairly powerful neurotoxin. We know a lot more about mercury now than we ever did. We also are much more aware that just because you put mercury, you know, and contain it in a product doesn't mean that people won't be exposed to it when that product, you know, shatters.
Well, what should you do if you break a thermometer?
The first thing, obviously, is this is a great opportunity for people to look in their medicine cabinet and see if they have a mercury-containing thermometer and then to dispose of it properly.
How do you do that?
You really put it aside in a safe container and wait till there's a household hazardous waste program, collection program. Most communities in this day and age do have household hazardous waste collection programs. Sometimes you have to travel some distance to get to it, but it really is worth the effort to dispose of it properly.
Okay, and what if it's too late, like me? You know, I think it happened when I shook it and it just broke.
The first thing is not to panic. The second is to make sure that you want to keep your kids and your pets sort of away from the spill. And then you want to go about picking up the spill. And actually, surprisingly, it's not that difficult to pick up mercury.
Well, in fact, my hospital said you can pick it up with tape or a wet paper towel. What do you recommend?
Tape is a good way to do it. It's a little globule. You're going to see a little globule, and if you can't see it, you can use a flashlight, and it's going to reflect back. You can use tape. You can use an index card and sort of move it up onto the index card. Or the best way of all is to use an eyedropper if you have one around.
Okay. And then what? Same instructions, take it to a hazmat drop-off
site? Yes, you want to put it away safely, obviously, where the kids and the pets can't get to it. And then you want to look to see when the next household hazardous waste collection program is and take it and dispose of it.
And we understand you don't want to just toss it out because it'll go back into a landfill and infect the groundwater. Joe Minot, Executive Director of the Clean Air Council on the Dangers of Mercury. Joe, I think I'll live. I think actually my cold is going to do me more harm than the mercury. But thanks so much for helping us out.
Well, thank you for calling and good luck.
Well, whether it's a hazardous thermometer or toxic mortgage assets, we always love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. And you can always call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. We'd love to hear from you. Back with the Grammy-nominated East Village Opera Company in a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Hail, hail, gods of war! Tell us what we're fighting for!
Welcome back. So is it Wagner or Led Zeppelin?
Machine.
both. The Ride is the opening track on the East Village Opera Company's most recent venture into rock meets aria. The group channels, if you will, what Richard Wagner's The Ride of the Valkyries might sound like if he were writing and performing today. The CD is called Old School, and on it the East Village Opera Company puts classics from Wagner, Handel, Puccini, Mozart, Verdi, and Bach through rock's classic prism. They're up for a Grammy Award Sunday night for Best Classical Crossover. Who knew? So we thought we'd take this opportunity to revisit an interview we did back in the fall with two of the band's members, Peter Kiesewalter, the group's arranger, and Ty Lee Ross. He handles the lead vocals. We started by asking Peter how they go about arranging a song like The Ride, which mixes Wagner's Valkyrie with Led Zeppelin's Black Dog.
Take the score from the composer, just set it aside, don't look at it, and start with the lyric and the melody and take it from there. You know, we're just playing old music on new instruments.
Well, let's stay with Wagner, sort of in essay form. Wagner, Led Zeppelin, discuss.
Well, in the Valkyries, Wagner's writing about Norse mythology. That opera was premiered in 1871, and exactly 100 years later, Led Zeppelin is on their second and third records are using Norse mythology as their main thematic material. They're also overblown, massive spectacles. There's really a lot of similarities between the sort of arena rock of the late 60s, early 70s, and opera as we know it.
Let's listen to another one of your songs. This is King of the Night. It's your reimagining of Mozart's aria Queen of the Night from The Magic Flute. Let's listen. Tylee, the twist here, this aria is usually sung by a woman, a soprano. Here, you take the lead. And here's where it feels as if you've been listening to Freddie Mercury. It's not Queen of the Night, it's Queen.
I think any guy who's going to sing as high as you're kind of called upon to sing, singing that song, is going to sound a little bit like Frankie Mercury. Is going to sound a lot like Freddie Mercury because he was just, you know, he sat up so high,
yeah.
So much of the time.
And when you hear your songs, you know, you realize you're really struck by how thin a membrane there is between big rock operas and true opera.
When we first started, the goal wasn't to take opera songs and turn them into rock songs. Our launching off point was to ask ourselves how might these composers treat these if they had the instruments that we have and the musical awareness that we have of world music and all the different styles of music that have come along since the era of classical. How might these composers have treated this if they're writing the same melody today? And when you're talking about the membrane that separates opera from rock, I think the membrane is just a temporal membrane. It's just the it's a membrane of 150 years of neglect by popular music listeners.
Right, right.
And once you peel that off and you stick electric guitars into the orchestra and percussion and drums where the timpani sits, then you've basically got a rock band.
Let's listen to another track. This is Walk. It was inspired by Handel's Semele. Let's listen. What happens when you're playing? I mean, can you see...
People go bananas. I've never seen audiences... I've been playing my whole life, but they go a little cuckoo. in theaters or in clubs. And often it's in a place where people might not be that familiar with us, or there's a lot of skeptical people, and I would be one of them if someone dragged me to see a band that combines rock and opera. I probably wouldn't go. But so there's a bit of winning over that we have to do, and usually by the middle of the set, it certainly feels that we've done that to an audience that is demographically the most diverse I've ever experienced.
Well, let's remind ourselves, you know, why they might react in the way they do. We've been assuming a lot that people know the original, so let's just hear a little bit of soprano Kathleen Battle singing the aria "Jove Assist Me" from Handel's Semele. Hear her first. And now the East Village Opera Company's interpretation.
Something you should understand. Jove and Pip. I love my freaky wonderland. Jove and Pip. But trip behind my every mistake, I start to break.
I want to jump in to say that is not Ty Lee singing. That is the East Village Opera Company's Anne-Marie Milazzo singing Help Me, Jove, in Pity.
That's one track on that record that there, a lot of liberties were taken. That one's sort of more inspired by the original aria than it is like an arrangement of it. But all that to say, there are elements from the original in there, but they're kind of hard to hear in that version that we do.
That's Peter Kieswalter and Ty Lee Ross, co-founders of the group East Village Opera Company, or EVOC. Their new CD is called Old School.
That's old with an E.
Sure. And for more, you can go to our website, here-now.org, and we leave you. I mean, what's a segment on opera arias without a duet? We leave you with their version of Puccini's Madame Butterfly. It's called the Butterfly Duet. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.